Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang, where we shall be continuing with our Conversations with Sai book. I think this is the 36th or 37th episode, and we have had a very enlightening, educative journey so far, and I'm sure that is what will continue as well. As always, joining all of you along with me is also Brother Prem, and we begin by offering our humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. We will continue from where we had stopped off the week before last week, because last week we had a special on the Radio Sai anniversary, Bhagwan's visit to the studio. We had relived some beautiful moments along with Brother Sai Prakash last week. So the week before that, we were discussing a conversation between Bhagwan and Hislop, where Swami tells Hislop that more important than loving God is to be worthy of God's love. It's in that context that we also went through the popular poem by Leigh Hunt, which is Abu Ben Adam. And Swami says there that the best way to draw God's love onto yourself is by leading a life of satya and dharma, a life of truth and righteousness. So that was a brief summary of where we ended the last time. So now we will continue with the conversation, and we shall see in today's conversation that a lot of questions from different themes are asked. It's also because there are multiple people asking the question. So, in that sense, it is not very connected. But then, Swami is the master sutradhari, and we shall see towards the end that all of it connects and builds up into one beautiful insight and message. All of that coming up in today's episode. But before we go further, let's welcome Brother Prem. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind, and Sairam to all our listeners. And yes, as you said, a lot of themes are going to be shifting from one theme to the other drastically here. But as we can see, the answers which Swami gives sometimes might be very, very specific to the person asking the question, but definitely a lot to learn, even that being the case. So we'll go to the first question that Hislop is asking. He asks a question, I think it must be based on something that Swami must have mentioned earlier in a conversation, or Swami must have mentioned in a discourse, because he says, Swami speaks of facing God. Can you please explain? And Swami's answer to that is, when two people face each other, each enters the eye of the other, and they are different only in name and form. Otherwise, they are the same. So it is important to face God directly and be one with Him. That is why one naturally closes the eyes in a temple, so as to use the eyes of wisdom instead of the physical eye. So that's Swami's answer to that. That's why the answer seems to be alluding to some reference that Swami must have made earlier. But this is, I think, a point which Swami would often quote, that when we go to a temple, we immediately close our eye. And Swami would especially make this reference about some very, very sacred and holy shrines in India, which is pretty inaccessible or pretty arduous, the journey of getting there. And Swami would say, after all that, you go stand in front of the deity and close your eyes. Mm. Swami would say, because you know heart of hearts that the Lord is actually within. The whole experience is to discover the Lord within, not necessarily the Lord in the shrine.
And even the Lord without, I mean the Lord who is outside, is only a support to discover the Lord within. In fact, Swami would narrate the story of Adi Shankara, how he stood before the Himalayan shrine and confessed to the Lord, asking forgiveness for three sins that he has committed. And one of the sins there, he says, is having firmly rooted myself in the belief, in the conviction that God is everywhere, having propagated the same, you know, because Adi Shankara is the foremost proponent of the Advaita philosophy. He says, having propagated the same, I'm still here in front of you, confessing to you and talking to you as if you're separate from me. So that itself is my first sin. So Swami, as you said, has always emphasized on being able to discover the Lord within. And the the representation of the Lord outside, be it an idol, be it a photograph, or be it the beautiful form of Swami that the world enjoyed for 86 years. All of these are just supports or things to prod us on, catalysts to make us discover that internal God on our own. And, you know, that is so true, because I remember, you know, the first time I saw Swami from up close, it was such a magical experience. It's inexplicable. Something happens, you know. At first, you may think that possibly it is your awe and respect and how you are holding, how you hold Swami in your eye, and or you may think that possibly it's all the environment there, the paraphernalia, possibly the hair of Swami or the perfume that he uses, or we might first attribute it to all of these things. But then, you know, we have read about so many people who have come to Swami for the first time, not with any reverence or awe or anything, and yet they are bowled over the first time they have seen Swami. So, I myself, when I look at my own life, I have had the opportunity to meet several celebrities, and I know what it feels to meet a celebrity. You know, my sporting hero, my musical icon. I have, by Bhagwan's grace, I have had the opportunity to meet them, and it really feels fantastic. But you know, none of that comes even close to what you feel when you see Swami. It is something magical, and I feel this, the reason why this happens is because possibly when we interact with icons or celebrities or our heroes, we are interacting at a bodily level and maybe at the level of our mind, our senses. Our mind, senses and body is interacting and they experience something. But with Bhagwan, there is something that happens at the level of the soul. You know, like how Swami says here, when you sit facing God, you are reflected, you know, God is reflected in your eye and you are reflected in God's eye. And if we think about it, this is an infinite reflection. You know, when we sit in a barber shop for our haircut, there's a mirror in front and a mirror behind, and we see that infinity. I think that's what happens when we are in the presence of God, even, you know, even in the physical presence. When you sit there, you get your soul, possibly your true nature gets an experience of that infinity. And that is the thrill that you feel. Though that experience may have some physical and mental symptoms, the experience cannot be adequately captured by the physical and mental symptoms alone. And that is why it is so special. And I think it is made special because, as Swami says here, that physical standing face to face to God, face to face with God, is to inspire us to always be face to face with God internally as well.
Yeah, I think another way probably of looking at it is, I think, I don't know whether Swami has mentioned it in the series of conversations that we're going through, where Swami would often speak about when you look away from the sun and when you look at the sun. Swami would give that example of when you're facing away from the sun, you're actually facing the shadow, which is similar to you being face to face with Maya. Or you turn towards the sun and then the shadow falls behind you. Swami would say that that's the relationship you have to have with God. But of course, Swami is taking it a step further by saying that, you know, this is again a part of the optical understanding of how things work, which Swami has also mentioned. I think earlier also there was a question of, you know, when I see another person, the person I'm seeing is actually the person in my mind. I think that's a question that Hislop had asked. And Swami was explaining, yes, because that's what is the entire universe as we see it is nothing but what occurs to us in our mind. And Swami gave the example of, you know, when somebody is in deep sleep, the entire universe vanishes for that person. So it is more of Swami, probably we could say that Swami is telling that when you're face to face with God, you're being aware of God, and being aware of God is itself recognizing God's presence within you. But dear listeners, definitely this is a stretch of what Swami is saying here, because we clearly are not sure what this is about. There must be a certain context to this, and that's why Swami must be explaining this. But at this point, I think it looks a little disjointed in the conversation.
So with that, we move on to the next question, which a visitor asks Swami. And he says, the word sadhana is used in so many different places. And Swami replies, sadhana is just replacement of the bad tendencies of the mind by the divine attributes of the Atma. Mind has two principal bad characteristics. One, its tendency not to go straight, but to move obliquely. and two, its tendency to desire and grasp all objects that it sees. It is compared to the snake, which moves by twisting and bites all it sees. The mind must go straight to God by facing Him directly. So, Swami makes it very clear that sadhana is not some esoteric term. It is basically replacing the bad tendencies of the mind with the divine attributes of the Atma. It is to ensure that the mind, which is like a snake, which Swami says, one is it doesn't go straight, it keeps going left, right, and the other thing Swami says is it desires and it's attracted to everything that it sees, just like a snake bites all that it sees. So sadhana is about ensuring the mind doesn't do this. The mind moves straight towards God, and again Swami uses that term saying facing Him directly. So I think Swami demystifies and removes the halo that is often attached to the word sadhana. And that is being said in our scriptures as well, where they say that sadhana is all about just purifying the chitta or purifying the intellect. Purifying so that you are able to perceive everything the way it should be perceived. You know, Swami would say, what appears to be real is not real, and what appears as unreal is actually real. So, the process of training the mind to see reality as it should be seen, I think that is what sadhana is all about.
I think it's one of the most lucid explanations that Swami gives for sadhana. Just replacing bad tendencies of the mind with divine attributes of the Atma. In fact, if this is a beautiful touchstone for all of us who ask, you know, I'm doing sadhana for so long, am I progressing? Or what is the sadhana that I'm supposed to do? I think the answer lies in this. If after years of doing whatever you're doing, you find that your mind is spontaneously having good thoughts, then the sadhana is working. And what is the sadhana one has to do? I think that is what, anything that makes you stay on the path, anything that makes you spontaneously think good thoughts, I think that is what is the sadhana. So if listening to discourses helps you in that, attending bhajans helps you in that, doing seva helps you in that, anything that helps you attain this, as Swami would beautifully put it, he would say that removing the vasanas of the mind with samskaras. I think that is again going to come later also, where Swami is going to explain that about removing the bad smell in a room. Because that's the example Swami would give. Vasanas are the past tendencies which take you away, and you remove them through samskaras. There are two ways of looking at sadhana. As one, which you very rightly said about purifying the mind. Because Swami says purification of the mind will automatically make it reflect the Atma. Right? And Swami would say that is the process of chitta shuddhi, doing your prescribed duties, doing all kinds of japa, dhyana, and all of that also helps in that. The other way is to ensure that the right kind of inputs go in. Just like how vasanas are created by inputs which come from outside, Swami says even samskaras can be brought in the same way. Right? Even though it is your tendency, Swami would say to be loving, to be compassionate, to be kind is your tendency, but still you can bring it from outside within you also through the good company that you keep, to the kind of books that you read, the kind of people you interact with. So Swami is very, very clearly and beautifully saying that sadhana is nothing but removing those bad or wrong tendencies of the mind and replacing them with good tendencies.
It also makes it so clear that the focus is not about what we are doing, but what we are achieving. You know, Swami is not concerned whether I am going to stand on one leg, or I am going to sit in Padmasan, or I am going to chant 1,000,000 times His name, or I am going to do Akhand Bhajan, or I am going to do Narayan Seva. I think it's more about, as a result of that, have I grown in my love for Swami? Do more good thoughts come within me? So I think it makes the definition of sadhana much more flexible than, you know, saying that you are not doing any sadhana at all because I don't see you rolling a rosary bead, rosary garland in your hand, nor do I see you attending any bhajans. It's not about that. Sadhana is about how much am I growing in my love for Swami. And as Swami says it very clearly here, we have to take on the divine attributes of the Atma, which is like becoming like Swami. becoming like Swami. So, if you know, while eating food, it helps for me to think that this morsel has come from Swami's plate, it is Swami's divine food, whatever, you know, I'm just telling this randomly. Anything that helps to build that love for Swami and the ability to see my dear Swami in everything and everyone around, that becomes sadhana. And anything else that is done which is not resulting in this, we may be under the wrong impression that it is sadhana. It just becomes hard effort which is not resulting or fructifying into anything.
And the following explanation which he gives also is like very clarifying in that sense. Because Swami is saying the mind's nature is to be distracted. I think that's what Swami says by telling that it has the nature of moving in an oblique manner, or it starts chasing everything that it sees, starts biting everything it sees. Swami is talking about the distracted nature of the mind.
Hmm.
And sadhana is nothing but putting the mind on track, on that straight line to God.
Focus.
Right, as Swami was very beautifully telling in one of the discourses, I think the 70s, Samakos discourses, Swami was saying that now I'm giving a discourse and you're all sitting and listening. There must have been somebody in the crowd who was actually thinking this, because Swami was saying that. Swami was saying, see, somebody might be there in the crowd who's thinking, okay, Swami has just started the discourse. The discourse is going to take one more hour. If I slip out of the hall now and catch the bus, I can go in time for the last show at this particular theater, Swami is saying.
Mm-hmm.
So Swami is saying, see, that is natural, because probably while coming you would have seen the poster, or somebody might have told you about the movie, and that interest to see that movie has come in your mind. Right? And so sitting here you're thinking of that. But what you're supposed to do is, you're supposed to say, no, this opportunity of listening from Swami is very, very rare. So I should not give up this opportunity for something so frivolous. So Swami is saying that though the mind is having the tendency of going astray, you take charge of it and say that, no, this is more important. So Swami is saying that is what has to be done with the mind. And that is you, everything that you do in the name of sadhana is to empower the buddhi to guide you in the right manner and give you the power to follow that.
We now move on to Hislop, who now says, Baba says, why fear when I am here? That must have a wide and deep meaning. Will Baba speak of it? And Swami says, I am refers to the Atma, who is always everywhere. The Atma is like the lion, without fear. Fear refers to the body, which is subject to worry, depression, trembling and fear. Body is like a sheep, wavering this way and that way. Body is always looking for information, gathering information, questioning. Whereas Atma, like the lion, is full of courage and without fear. Atma is God. You are God. God is omnipresent. This I is you. That I is you. You are all. This is a beautiful interpretation of why fear when I am here. Because every time when we use the statement, why fear when I am here, we use it in the sense that Swami is with us, guiding us, Swami is above us, below us, around us, Swami is like our shadow. So when Swami is here, why fear? But here Swami is saying that I refers to Atma. You know, it is a reminder that the divine that you are searching for everywhere, in Prashanthi Nilayam, in places of pilgrimage, in other people, in other gurus, in different places, is all hidden within you. You just have to discover that. And once you discover that, there's no need for any fear at all. Swami is saying that the fear that you have in life is because you have not yet realized this truth of the Atma within you, the divinity within you. Once you realize that, there's no fear at all. And this statement is just a constant reminder of that truth. Why fear when I am here? Meaning, recognize that I, and then you lose all your fear. It's almost like the English version of the Soham mantra. Swami says when we breathe, we take in the breath, so, and hum when we release the breath. And so hum means I am that, meaning tatvamasi, or I am the divine. And Swami says, I think 21,600 times a day, your own body keeps reminding you of your reality, if only you focus on your breath. So also this why fear when I am here is like a mantra which helps us focus on the reality that we are all essentially divine. Once we associate ourselves not with the body and the mind but with that divinity, then there'll be no reason for any fear.
And it's pretty much what, you know, very similar to what Krishna tells Arjuna. They often speak of the six types of decay which the body undergoes, or six types of change it is called. Pretty logical to understand. One is to be born, to grow, to change, to decay, to die, and the state of existence. So they say that all of these you're attached to, right? And any change in this, it refers to the body as well as anything material. When you have something, you're worried that it'll decay. You're worried that it is there now, it won't be there tomorrow. You're worried that, you know, somebody might take it off. So when you're talking about the Atma, there is nothing. The Atma is, you know, described as something which does not have the six modifications. That's one of the definitions of the Atma. As you rightly said, it's a very beautiful and different interpretation of why here when I'm here. Because as, that is the essence of what Krishna tells Arjuna in the second chapter. He says all fear is based on only all these modifications. That something will happen to my body. Something will happen to somebody who is dear to me. So when you know that you are not the body, then there is no place for fear at all. So that is the, the whole Advaita concept, Swami has put it in that, why fear when I am here. And I don't think we've come across this explanation of that dictum anywhere else.
Exactly. It's almost like, Swami is, as I said right in the beginning, though there are diverse questions, Swami is unifying them. In the beginning, Swami indicated how the external form of the Lord is also just a way to inspire us or motivate us or guide us or support us into discovering the true internal God. I feel the same about the two interpretations of why fear when I am here also. When you think of why fear when I am here as why do you fear when you have Swami with you? I think that is the supporting, the first basic level. From that, we have to advance to this level of realizing that there is no difference between me and Swami. So I have to live as confidently, as fearlessly, as wonderfully as Swami. On that note, dear listeners, we will take a quick little break. And on the other side of the break, we will continue with, again, a diverse range of questions which are asked by Hislop as well as a few visitors who are seated there along with him.
Ram Rasam Ram Rasam Pibare Pibare Ram Rasam राम रसो पिबरे पिबरे राम रसो पिबरे राम रसो Pibare, pibare Ram Rasam Pibare Ram Rasam Rasani Pibare Ram Rasam Pibare Ram Rasam Rasani pibare Ram Rasam Pibare Ram Rasam Rasani pibare Ram Rasam Pibare Ram Rasam Ram Rasam Pibare Janana Marana Bhaya Shoka Viduram ಜನನ ಮರಣ ಭಯ ಶೋಕವಿ ದೂರ ಜನನ ಮರಣ ಭಯ ಶೋಕವಿ ದೂರ ಸಕಲ ಶಾಸ್ತ್ರ ನಿಗಮಾಧವ ಸಾರ ಸಕಲ ಶಾಸ್ತ್ರ ನಿಗಮಾಗಮ ಸಾರ ಬಿಫರೇ ರಾಮರಸ ರಸರೆ ರಾಮರಸೌ ರಸರೆ ಬಿಫರೆ ರಾಮರಸೌ ರಾಮರಸೌ ಬಿಫರೆ ಶುದ್ಧ ಪರಮ ಹಂಸಾಶ್ರಮ ಗೀತ ಶುದ್ಧ ಪರಮ ಹಂಸಾಶ್ರಮ ಗೀತ ಶುಕ ಶೌನಕ ಕೌಶಿಕ ಮುಖ ಪೀಠ ಶುಕ ಶೌನಕ ಕೌಶಿಕ ಮುಖ ಪೀಠ ಬಿಫರೆ ರಾಮರಸ ರಸರೆ ಬಿಫರೆ ರಾಮರಸೌ ರಸರೆ ಬಿಫರೆ ರಾಮರಸಂ ರಾಮರಸಂ ರಾಮರಸೋ
Welcome back, dear listeners. We will go to the next couple of questions because they are similar and then have the discussion. So a visitor asks, Swami, what is jnana? Jnana. And Swami says, jnana is ordinary knowledge, knowledge about living in the world. Special knowledge is wisdom. Love is giving and forgiving. Self is getting and forgetting. Love is expansion and selfishness is contraction. The visitor further says, I see evil on all sides and I'm puzzled. I think he says this because Swami is speaking about giving, forgiving and not being selfish. So he says that, but I see evil on all sides, I'm puzzled. And Swami says, here is this banana. Maybe there was a banana in the interview room. The skin is useless to us, so it is regarded as bad. But if there were no skin, the inside would not be protected. Do not regard anything as bad. If a person has done evil to you and you take it as evil and retaliate, then you would have also become bad. But by remaining good and not regarding others as evil, you gain the right to reform them. If there's a bad smell in the room and if incense is lighted, the fragrance changes the smell of the room. Bad actions should be met with good deeds and a good viewpoint. And the evil will be changed. The difference between good and bad is just a function of time. Food when eaten is good. In time, the same food undergoes a change, is excreted and is called bad. Whereas truth remains the same and does not change with the passage of time. Therefore, the time sequence is just imagination. Now, I just got a feeling that when he asked what is jnana, Swami gave him a reply and after that, actually, Swami conferred wisdom through this statement about good and bad because it's very interesting to see how Swami is saying that in the ultimate sense, even what you think of bad is good, because it is that bad that fosters the good, that protects the good, that makes you recognize the good, makes you aware of the good. It's almost like without the bad, the good will not exist at all.
Right. That's a beautiful example, and Swami would often give this, I think, there are examples of other fruits also, I think.
Orange
and bitter peel, and I think pineapple also, Swami would say that. But it's a...
In slightly different context. Like, I remember the orange, he would say it as nasukhat labhyate sukham.
Right.
From joy alone, you won't get joy. From bitter experience, you get sweet. And then give the example of the orange.
Right.
So, similar.
But I think the point which Swami is saying, even as I was reading this, I was thinking how logical this is. That, you know, the example that Swami gives, when there is a foul smell in the room, we always do what needs to be done to get rid of the foul smell. We don't really, in that sense, I mean, that is what we refer to as fighting the foul smell. But when it comes to any other human relationships, if something has gone wrong, you know, we are angry with somebody, or somebody has made us very upset, or, you know, has cheated us in any way, we only do things which complicate the matter more. It is like saying that you walk into a room where there's foul smell, and you do things which make the room more foul, right? But it's so logical, but I don't know how we understand it logically, but I don't think it's easy to follow. Right?
Because I think we have this feeling that the fellow who fouled the room must himself clean it. Otherwise, why should I? I'll also foul it. You know?
Right. It's almost like that. But in a sense, it's the most simple thing to understand. Right. So he says that there is something which is wrong. You have to do what it takes to make it right. I think this is applies to all relationships, interpersonal relationships, relationships between a mother and a child, husband and wife, friends, everything. If we have this in our mind, as I don't know whose quote it is, whether it's Abraham Lincoln's or Rabindranath Tagore's, he says, "Am I not killing my enemies when I get rid of enmity?" Right? He says, if somebody is an enemy, if I get rid of enmity, I'm making friends out of them. He says, am I not killing my enemies when I make friends out of them? Right? I think that is the attitude which Swami is speaking about. It's logical, but I think it needs a lot of practice to do that.
In a worldly sense, people often advise by saying, you be the bigger man, or you be the bigger person here. I think that is what is meant by expansion love, being the bigger person. And that is what Swami says also. Love is about expansion, whereas selfishness is contraction. If we look at it a bit deeper, this expansion comes from realizing that it is the same principle within me as well as in all the others around. And that is how I expand myself, you know. If you ask anybody in the world, not just me, whom they love the most, the true answer would be themselves. One might say that one loves his spouse or his parents or his children or, you know, friends or even Swami. But the truth is, we love ourselves the most. And that is why Swami doesn't say that don't love yourself. He doesn't say that. But he just says, love yourself but realize who you truly are. Once you realize that, you will realize that your love becomes selfless, because you realize that the person sitting opposite to you is also you in the true sense, once you have stopped identifying yourself with just the body and the mind. When you identify with the divine principle within, you will see that same divine principle, the same spark in everything around you. And that is why, you know, it is about growing in love, becoming expansive. Swami says, love is giving and forgiving, self is getting and forgetting. Love is expansion, selfishness is contraction. So, when we are able to do that, you know, I think we will be able to be the bigger person, and we will be able to bring fragrance even in the most stinking of rooms.
There is this, I forgot his role in the organization, Dr. Joe Fanoff. You know, he has this presentation which he gives, I think, for personality development or something. And quite often he uses that image that Swami had materialized, of Swami speaking to Swami, right? Which Swami had materialized for some MBA students. So
that's
he would
correct.
Often show that, and essentially that's a beautiful image which you should always keep in mind, that whomever you're interacting with, remember that it is the Swami in you who is interacting with the Swami in the other person. So oftentimes the question that he gets asked is, what about times when the other person is being very unreasonable or being very rude? He says, yeah, just imagine that the other Swami is having an off day. Can you be the more pleasant Swami? And the way he was saying it, he said, see, we've all seen that aspect of Swami's personality also. Sometimes to you, Swami might appear unreasonable. Swami might be very angry, very upset. Many times we have faced it. We have no clue why Swami is angry or why Swami is upset. Swami is not talking to us suddenly. Swami is ignoring us suddenly. But we accept it because it is coming from Swami. At some level we say that, yeah, Swami, there must be a reason for it. So he says, when every interaction with you, can you look at the other person who is being unreasonable also like that? It is coming from Swami, but we have also seen the loving aspect of Swami. So in this interaction, can I be that loving Swami? So that is, I think, a very beautiful way of looking at it. But what Swami is saying here is very beautiful. He's saying that there is no good. I mean, there is no bad in that sense. Everything is only your perception. And what Swami says is, you know, the truth alone is unchanging. So if something is good and it has become bad, or something is bad and it has become good, then it is not truth. Anything that undergoes modification can never be true in that sense.
You know, when you were speaking about Swami interacting with the other Swami, I'm reminded of what Ramani sir told, that Swami had told him, for success in any endeavor that he takes up. Swami told him that before you go to meet a particular person or whoever it is, superior to you or lower in rank to you, doesn't matter. Before going, just for once, think of me. You know, Swami makes everything so much more simpler and easier. Swami did not say that all the while keep reminding yourself that that is Swami in front of you. Swami said, if you are able to remember me once before you go and actually meet that person, that's enough. I will take care of the rest. You know, just think of me once. So it is so much more simplified, because we often feel, I can see Swami in the people who are nice, like you said, but in people who are being very unreasonable, even when you say think of Swami as having an off day, if it's a stranger or a person whom we meet fairly irregularly, it's okay. But if you're meeting a person on a regular basis and by nature that person seems to be, you know, very explosive, losing his cool, shouting, talking extra, it becomes even difficult to imagine that possibly it is Swami having an off day, because an off day cannot be 5 days of the week. So in such circumstances, I think this other advice which Swami had shared with Ramani sir, and Ramani sir shared it with all of us, is so beautiful. Swami said, forget everything, offer everything to me, think of me once before actually going. Before meeting that person or anything, before you do anything with that person, just think of me once and remember that I will be guiding the flow of that entire interaction. So I think that is a simple thing which I have tried, which has worked. It has worked to the extent of me being able to put that effort. So I really think it's a very, very neat and practical tip. We can definitely start practicing it. Whether we are coming for an afternoon satsang, whether we are going to meet somebody very pleasant, or we are going to meet somebody very unpleasant, whatever be the circumstance, think of Swami once sincerely and know that Swami is taking over that interaction, and then proceed.
Right, and I think this is also an example of how Swami would often say that, you know, seeing Swami in everyone or to remember Swami all the time is probably the goal that you're trying to reach. But then you use that in your everyday activity also. Like the fact that you see Swami in everyone, probably when you become, hopefully someday, that jnani who is able to see God in everyone, or that devotee who is so devoted that he cannot see anything other than Swami everywhere. We will reach that state eventually, but you can always use that truth. Swami says that that is the fact, whether you accept it or not. And Swami is going to tell later, God is in everyone. You might not acknowledge it at this point in time, but given the truth, you're informed of that truth. Can you use that truth in everyday life, in your interaction with difficult people, or, you know, when you're facing different situations in life?
And at this point, when you're listening to this, what is the question that comes in your mind? Swami, all that is true, but there are some really nasty people.
There will be one person who's popping up in each one's mind.
Whom you think of, and even as I was sharing that fact about, you know, not an off day, right? Generally, Swami is like this. I had one person in my mind. I'm sure you also have one person in mind. And that is what happens with Hislop also, because Hislop says, Swami, the thought arises that some persons are wholly bad. Their crimes are so vicious. So, maybe not crimes in our mind, but we feel that some people's actions are so terrible, so influenced by anger, hatred, greed, and all the Arshad Vargas. So when Hislop says this, Swami replies, no person is wholly bad, for God is in every person's heart. A mother and son may fight in court over property, but the relationship of mother and son remains. Two people who have come to hate each other live in two houses. Each has a picture of Baba over the door. The house represents the body, and Baba's picture represents the God resident in the soul. The body may have to be corrected in its behavior, and the best way is to attract the person with love. There is absolute good, but there is no absolute bad. Bad changes. Bad is a distorted aspect of the good. But it is not possible when one has ordinary physical vision to see good and bad as one. Only when one knows the divine spark in oneself and in others, only then one sees good and bad as the same.
Talking about this question where Hislop is asking that people who are wholly bad, their crimes are so vicious. I recall the conversation which we had with Ms. Charu Sinha. I don't know what is her designation right now, but I think at that time she was the superintendent of police somewhere near Anantapur or somewhere like that. The Swami's
high in the police ranks.
Right, one of the IPS officers. She had this to say, you know, she says that, you know, probably the kind of people I have met and I have interacted, none of you would have actually come across such people, because I have met people who have done heinous crimes. Right? That person is standing in front of me and I'm being told of what that person is doing, which no normal human being would have done. I'm sure there might be crimes which we cannot talk about here. So she was saying that, you know, such people, when you're standing in front of you and you have to interact with them, I find it so very difficult to keep reminding myself of this, what Swami says, that, you know, there is God in each one. And she says that, but this is the only thing which keeps me sane. Right? Because when you're looking at people like that, there are points in time when you lose faith in humanity itself. That, you know, that there's no question of man becoming God or man transforming. You see people, repeated offenders. So she said that, you know, for me to hold on to these two things, which Swami has said in this one particular paragraph, that there is divinity in each one, however much that divinity is hidden from plain sight. There is divinity in each one. And I say that she was saying that I have to keep reminding myself of that. And this brilliant tool that Swami often speaks of, the separation of the crime from the criminal. He says, without these two tools, I cannot lead a life of sanity. And, you know, and she says that so many prisoners and, you know, criminals whom she's interacted with, she has seen transformation over many, many years because of this attitude with which she has been able to deal with them. So, you know, when we are talking about people who are wholly criminal, I don't think any of us would come across that kind of people, or at least as many number of people with that kind of a portfolio. But if a person of her cadre says that it works and I've seen it working in front of me, I think it is really a validation of what Swami is saying here at this point.
I forget the name of the author, but we had a chapter in our English course called To Serve With Love. It's about this person who is given a very, very, in quotes, negative and bad neighborhood to teach in a public school in the United States. And he speaks about how, with firmness yet with a lot of love, he was able to transform the whole class. I think it was in our class, grade 8. It is a chapter called To Serve With Love. Maybe it's from a book of the same name, you know, To Serve With Love. It's phenomenal. Even that chapter itself was so inspiring. I remember reading it 2-3 times, because the kind of retorts with so much of wit, so much of humor. That is one more thing, you know, I feel is an expression of love. Love definitely has a lot of humor associated with it. We have seen it with Swami. We have seen it with all the people who genuinely have love, because, you know, laughter is the best medicine. There is so much humor, and that love is so healing. That school, which was considered as one of the worst in the neighborhood, actually comes up in terms of its scholastics, academics, and even most importantly, in the civility and behavior of the students there. In fact, a movie has been made on that book, and that movie has inspired many of our own local Indian Bollywood remakes of the movie, where, you know, a teacher is given charge of some very difficult students, and she or he realizes that these students are not difficult by nature, but they are just lacking in love. Give enough love to them and they'll get transformed. We also have the experience of, I forget his name, in the metro train when he's...
Al Honig.
Hal Honig, yes, Hal Honig. When he's traveling by train, a man comes up to him with a switchblade knife, tells him to give away everything that he has. At that time, Hal Honig remembers what Swami has said, that it's the same divinity in all. With all his love, genuinely seeing Swami there, he offers him some sandwiches and he sees this person who had come to rob him melt right in front of his eyes, you know. He melts and later on he tells, sir, have a good day, and gets off the train without robbing Hal Honig or, you know, causing any damage. So, the power of love to be experienced has to be, you know, experimented. We have to try it out and then we have to see it. And once the experience comes, I think our conviction also builds. And that is what Swami is saying here. I feel the statement that we need to make it bold and underline and keep it in our heart is, there is absolute good, but there is no absolute bad.
Right, absolutely. I think that's a very, very profound statement, where it is first of all instructive in a sense, the way we have to look at the world and the people around us. At the same time, it is hopeful towards us also, right? There is a state of absolute good which we can reach, but there is nothing like absolute incorrigible bad. Mm. That even if we look at ourselves and say that, oh, Swami, I'm beyond repair, that's never the case. So it is with everyone around. There is a possibility for change. And the other point that Swami was saying is, it's only a contortion of good. Bad is nothing but... as Swami was saying, the same food that you eat the next day, it becomes bad and you say it is foul. Mm. And the same food that you cook today, in another discourse, Swami was saying, the same food that you cook today and you relish, the next day it is actually spoiled, just left alone. You're not doing anything to it. Left alone in a corner, you know, time spoils that food, Swami says. So what is good and what is bad? Right? Nobody has done anything. The nature of that food is not bad. Right, the time has played on it and it has made it bad. So whom do you put the blame on? So in that sense, Swami is saying that when you say something is good, something is bad, as we have seen in the case of so many people who take the wrong way, the wrong upbringing, the kind of wrong experiences and bad experiences they have along the way, which has made them the way they are. So where do you put the blame? In fact, even in jurisprudence, there is a question which is heavily debated. Whom do you punish for a crime? Right, because every time a criminal always has a backstory which says that their upbringing was not fine, or they were brought up in a poor neighborhood. So much of it, as Swami would say, we are to be blamed for anybody who is taking to a wrong path. Mm. So in that sense, to be able to look at everything as essentially good, I think that is a practice in itself, which is a lifelong effort it'll take to get to that kind of thinking.
And that is the crux of all of Swami's message, right? Like, even when Swami defines what is true devotion, he says true devotion is to accept whatever comes to you in life as good for you. So, seeing goodness in everything, in everybody, in all situations, in, you know, whatever you may think of, that is the crux of spirituality. And Swami says that only a person who is able to do that is a true devotee. Anybody who feels that something bad happened to him or her cannot be a devotee. That is the kind of definition Swami gives for a true devotee or for devotion. To be able to see everything that is happening to you as good for you. You know, that is the definition Swami gives for surrender as well. So it's almost like surrender, devotion, love, or jnana, or whatever you call. These are all different terms looking at the same diamond through different facets. That's all it is, because they all boil down to the same thing. In fact, Swami's answer is not yet over, because Swami continues by saying, if one can adopt as an attitude the truth that good only is real and that all one sees is essentially good, even though distorted, one acquires a great strength if he can see the world this way. The learned might argue about the world and say that all this is illusion and despair. But they can never hope to live without loving the world. Love is not to be disregarded. The world might seem to be untruth from a material viewpoint, but the world is truth if looked at from the transcendental viewpoint. So once again, you know, it is such a important statement here. Again, another thing to be underlined and highlighted in bold is that when Swami is saying that the learned might argue that about the world and say it's all illusion and despair, but they can never hope to live without loving the world. You cannot be happy unless there is love. You cannot be peaceful unless there is love. In fact, Swami goes to the extent of saying, you cannot live if there is no love. So, you know, whatever excuse we make up for not loving somebody or something, you know, be it that the other person or that thing is bad, it's bad and therefore I'm not loving, or I'm trying to practice detachment and therefore I'm not loving. I don't want to love because the moment I love, I get into either attachment or lust. Whatever excuse you can give, if we give up love because of that excuse, it is not right. Of course, we have to refine our love. We have to ensure that love is freed from attachment. Love is freed of, lust. All that has to be done. Love is freed of all the desires. Love becomes selfless. But giving up love is never the solution. Because Swami is saying that once that happens, you can't live in the world. Forget being peaceful in the world or happy in the world. You just cannot live at all. Love, it's almost like love is life and life is love. No wonder Swami would address all of us in each and every discourse of his, possibly multiple times, as Prema Swarupulara.
Right. That's, the point that Swami is making is so very profound in that sense. Like, it is not only about the act of dismissing everything as an illusion, act of saying that the world is unreal, as Swami is stating here. It is also about finding ways of loving everything and every individual around here. And Swami would say, find whatever is the tool, as we were talking about it. If it means looking at everyone as an reflection of Swami, or thinking that there is a Swami in each one, find whatever tool it takes, but find a way by which you're able to love everyone. Because as they would say, that only Vairagya will not give you that kind of oneness. Vairagya is when you dismiss everything as unreal. Swami would say that will never work. Bring you that idea of oneness, which is the ultimate state. It has to be gone through love. I mean, that's why it's, I think, a very, very profound point that Swami is making here. You have to find a means by which you inculcate love for everything around. Look at it as a reflection of God, or look at it as a reflection of your own self, or find a sense of belonging. As Swami would say, that Vasudeva Kutumbakam is another way of looking at it. You might not be directly related to a person, but in some way, each one's happiness and each one's welfare matters to me. And that is the attitude with which you go out and serve. All of this is a means by which you can attain that oneness, not by defying it.
And that gives both of us and all of our listeners and everyone a lot of homework. I think, Prem, some time back we said that even as we are stating that statement, some person would have popped up in our mind. Well, now, going by what Swami has said, find a reason to love him or her now. And like that, anybody else who pops up in mind as incorrigible, unbearable, but what to do, I have to interact with him or her on a daily basis or a regular basis. I think we have to find reasons to love whatever it be, and that is part of the sadhana. On that note, dear listeners, we'll take another quick break, and on the other side of the break, continue with this conversation, a few more thoughts about good and bad, and a couple more questions asked on the same theme.
Love the love, love the love, love the love, love the love. Love the love of the beloved, love the love of the beloved.
love the love of the beloved, love the love of the beloved. Take love, don't break love, just make love your goal. So love the love of the beloved, oh love the love of the beloved, love the love of the beloved, love the love of the beloved. Hold it, enfold it, it's gold in your soul. So love the love, love the love.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were speaking about, not we actually, Swami speaking, and we were speaking about Swami speaking about good and bad and love and all that. And a very interesting thought struck me, Prem, that you see, goodness is associated with white and all the evil and black is associated with, all the evil and bad is associated with black. If we scientifically look at these two colors, black and white is a combination of all colors. Anything that appears white, the color white, is because it is just reflecting back all the colors. So all inclusiveness is white. And anything that appears black because it is absorbing all the colors and reflecting nothing. So nothingness is black, while everythingness, all inclusiveness, is white. In that sense, white is actually a true color, because white is made up of all the colors. Black is nothing but a lack of all colors. So black actually doesn't exist. You know, when all the other colors are not there, it's called black. It reminded me of this because very interestingly, we have made all bad things as black and all good things as white. Goodness is represented by white and bad is represented by black. And I think even scientifically now it becomes very clear how there is absolute good, there is absolute white. There is nothing like absolute black. It's just the absence. Like Swami would say, there is light and darkness is nothing but the absence of light. There is no darkness as such. There is only light or no light. If there is light, it is light. If there is no light, it is darkness. So also, there is only goodness. The lack of that goodness, possibly the lack of goodness to, or the distortion of goodness, as Swami says, appears as bad or evil, but there's nothing like absolute bad. I found this very, very phenomenal that black is not a color, but white is a harmonious blend of all colors.
Right. And I think the last statement that Swami made in that answer that he gave, it's quite intriguing and a little different from what otherwise Swami might have said. Swami saying the world might seem to be untruth from the material point of view, but the world is truth if looked at from the transcendental viewpoint.
Hmm.
The world being untruth from the material point of view, I think, is what is often spoken of in spirituality. Some would say that everything that changes is untrue. The material world is anityam, and so it is mithya. And these are all Swami's own explanations. But Swami is saying that yes, it is untrue from the material point of view when you're looking at it as being material and you being the divine aspect. But if you look at it from the transcendental point viewpoint, as Swami would often quote, the first lines of the Ishavasya Upanishad, it goes, Ishavasyam idam, Ishavasyam idam sarvam jagatyam jagat. Right? Swami would say that is the first statement of the Ishavasya Upanishad, which says that you have to look at this world as a vesture worn by God. And the moment you look at it that way, the way you will interact with the world will be completely different. Yes, you have to look beyond the world, but you will not have any kind of hatred or indifference towards the world. You know, just like how anything that is associated with Swami is given equal reverence. The act of Swami giving his robe to, I think, thousands of samitis and sai centers around the world have in their altar a robe of Swami. Mm. Right? It's after all a vesture that Swami wore, and it is having the same reverence that Swami would have had if, Swami being there.
Correct.
And anything that is associated with God should be loved and revered in the same manner.
Mm.
And that's what Swami is saying here. In the material sense, yes, it is true. It is unreal. It is changing. The relationships which were there yesterday are not going to be there tomorrow. In that sense, yes, it is unreal, and that is what is Vairagya all about. But that Vairagya is one side, but the other aspect is when you look at everything as being a reflection, as being a vesture, as being something which is where God is the indweller, the way you will look at it will be completely different. And that is the way by which you can find happiness and peace, not by denouncing everything as being unreal.
With that, we go to the next question where Hislop says, we are asking Swami about the bad people. How about the poor victim of a vicious action? And Swami replies, everyone is good, but there are bad actions. Action and reaction. In terms of the victims of bad action, everything was exactly right. We see only the present. Baba sees the past also. A 4-year-old boy was attacked by robbers for the gold chain around his neck. The robbers blinded the boy so that he could not identify them. The boy was crying bitterly that he could not see. The parents also were crying. They came to Baba. In the past life, the boy had been a cruel man who had blinded several people. The boy will continue blind, but as a man, if he starts to consider understanding that he is blind because of past dark deeds, and then sincerely repents his bad tendencies and makes a genuine and makes a genuine effort to change himself, praying to God to forgive him, Baba may forgive the karma and restore the eyesight.
Right. I think, again, it's very, very clear. Swami is giving the explanation of how to deal with difficult people, which all of us are most likely to encounter in life. Swami is saying that everything is good, but there are bad actions. I think this is a very, very important point which has to be kept in mind. In fact, sometime back also this particular explanation was there when Swami is, I think, talking about teachers or parents, where Swami said, yes, there is God in everybody, and yes, you have to see Swami in everyone, but a bad action is a bad action, has to be looked at that way. And people who are in a position of duty where they're supposed to correct another person, they have to make this distinction that the act is bad, the person has to be corrected. And then that should not be mixed with the fact that there is no good and bad and everything is divine and there is no, whatever Swami was saying in the previous one, there is nothing like bad, everything
exactly.
is a modification
that,
of good.
That balance becomes so important. I am at this point reminded of the experience of Swami Karunyananda. In 1974, he had accompanied Swami to Bombay. They were staying in Dharmakshetra. In fact, Swami Karunananda was given a room right beside Satyadeep, which is Swami's residence at Dharmakshetra, in a room when he was staying there. Even to this day, you know, the other side of this little hillock on which Swami's residence is an expansive slum. And that slum keeps expanding as time goes by. Now a wall has been erected there. But those days the slum was there, and as Swami Karunyananda was seated at his window somewhere before noontime, late in the morning, he saw that there were a few street urchins there in the slum fighting with dogs for some food. And you know, his heart melted in compassion. He felt so much for them. And he just thought, what kind of irony is this? Just a few meters away, here is the avatar of the age. And on the other side of the compound wall, there are boys, children fighting with dogs for food. How can this be? You know, what kind of injustice is this? What irony is this? Even as he was thinking this, there's a pat on his shoulder and he turns around to see Swami. His first expression is that of surprise, because he asks Swami, Swami, how did you get in the door when it was bolted? And Swami says, Karunananda, don't think that bolted doors can keep me away. Quickly, you know, Karunananda wakes up to the truth.
I think Swami makes a very beautiful statement. I don't know whether it was in this context or somebody who was speaking about this episode made that statement. Swami says, when I can enter bolted hearts, what is a bolted room for me?
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah, that is definitely true. Whether Swami made that statement there or it was somebody's inspired statement, that is definitely true. And you know, one more aspect that comes out from this is we need to constantly remind ourselves of Swami's reality, at least if not our own reality. Because it is the same whether we remind ourselves of Swami's reality or our reality. Because this happens. Familiarity breeds neglect, as they say. Even though we know Swami's avatar, we are fascinated, or we are, you know, our breath is taken off by the miracles and leelas that he does. So that's what happened briefly to Swami Karunyananda. But then, you know, Swami tells him, I have come here to call you and take you with me for lunch. Karunyananda is in no mood to eat lunch now, because having witnessed what he had witnessed, he doesn't feel like eating. He feels guilty to eat his own food. He says, Swami, I can't eat food. And Swami asks the reason why. He is hesitant to say, but says it nevertheless. And then Swami tells him, Karunyananda, you think that you are seeing something that Swami has not seen. Let me tell you, the case is the reverse. I am able to see things which you are not able to. And then Swami tells him that in the previous births, these boys whom you are now seeing were extremely wealthy and prosperous and rich. And they would, you know, just sample the food from their dining table here and there. And lot of it would go waste. They would not bother about the food being thrown off the table. And Swami said, as a result of that karma, they have now come fighting for those same scraps which they threw away and discarded. So, you know, that is where the incident and episode ends. But how many times, you know, we make this mistake of judging God based on what we see? Let me make it very clear here that It is not that we should not feel sympathy or compassion in our heart. That is definitely necessary. As long as we have this human birth, we have to feel that compassion, we have to feel that love. Though Swami knows everybody's karmas, he responded. Be it the Orissa flood, be it the earthquake in Gujarat, be it the Narayan Seva in Puttaparthi. Swami responded. Whenever Swami would see, he would be moved. But that never translated into criticizing or condemning God, doubting God's wisdom, doubting God's compassion. You know, we think that our hearts have melted, but Swami, your heart is not melting. I think that is what we have to be wary of. That while feeling compassion and sympathy is not bad, turning that into a judgmental expression against God is definitely something should be avoided, because that speaks of our ignorance and our false sense of ego, where we think that we are wiser than God or we have more compassion than God.
Yeah, I think this entire paragraph, I think Swami gives us the way to deal with bad fate or bad actions, whether it is happening to other people or to ourselves. Right? At one point, the question was about people who are in the receiving end of unjust happenings, whether it, you know, somebody who is being in the unfortunate side of a social divide, or about people who are, you know, recipients of somebody's cruel actions. So Swami is one. The first point that Swami is saying is there is bad action. There is nothing like, since everything is good and then God is in everything, there is nothing like good and bad. In fact, I think sometime before or in this paragraph, Swami says that that is a state which will come much later, where one is able to see good and bad as one. There is no distinction between the two. So don't confuse that state with your current state. In your current state, there is bad action, and you must use your discrimination to keep away from bad action. But then Swami says, in terms of the victims of bad action, Swami says there is nothing, this is again a statement which Swami would very often make, we've quoted it before. When somebody asks Swami, that Swami, why do innocent people suffer? Swami's single line answer to that is, innocent people don't suffer. Right?
Yeah.
Because God is just, right? As we look at God, yes, God is loving, God is compassionate and everything, but the underlying thing is God is just. You, the moment you say that somebody is innocent and they're suffering, you're questioning the integrity of God. That God is giving somebody a punishment which that person doesn't deserve. Which is never the case. That's why Swami says innocent people never suffer. And God is not somebody who metes out punishments out of hatred. And Swami would say that, see, good for good, bad for bad. That's how the system works. There's nothing like my compassion or my anger or my hatred against anybody in that. So in that sense, the one point is, karma is good or bad. There is no mixing of that. There is bad actions. It has to be looked at as that way. And when something happens to you, be absolutely sure, be absolutely clear of the fact that it has come to me only because in some way I was supposed to undergo this experience. This is not to hate ourselves and not to condemn ourselves and say that, oh, I'm a bad person. At the same time, when it happens to another person, to condemn that person. That you would have deserved this, because this is a very politically incorrect statement to make in the current scenario. This is like shaming the victim, as they would call it. It is not in that sense. It is not to say that you deserved it, so you had it. I think that's the last thing we should be saying to a person who's suffering. But this understanding, to have that understanding in mind all the time, is very, very important to deal with the problem when it happens to us as well as when it happens to the other person.
See, what you said is very important, because if I turn to somebody and tell it's your karma, you face it, that is the karma I am building up now. As a human being, Swami would say, Hridaya, I am supposed to feel the compassion. Yes, when I see somebody suffering, an earthquake comes or a natural calamity comes or anything, you know, anything bad happens, I am supposed to genuinely respond with love. But in my response for love, you know, it should not build up an ego in me that, look, you know, I'm more compassionate than God himself. Even God doesn't care for them, but I am caring for them. You know, that is wrong. That's why I said the being judgmental towards God is not right. But we have to respond. If a beggar comes to the doorstep, rather than, you know, Swami would say, if you can't give alms, at least don't shoo away that beggar rudely. Just, you know, salute and be quiet, if not anything. But you know, when a beggar comes, I tell, hey, you know what? This is your karma. You get lost, man. You deserve this. Know that you're deserving this, you know. When I'm saying that with so much of venom in me, that is a karma that I'm building and it will come back to me. I remember in this context, that story that Swami would tell of the extent ego goes. There is this beggar who comes begging for alms at a door. And the daughter-in-law of the house comes and tells the beggar that, see, we don't have anything at home. You kindly go on your way. I can't give you anything. And even as she says this, the mother-in-law is witnessing this whole scene in the background. She's infuriated. She comes and tells the daughter-in-law, "What? Who gave you the right to talk to the beggar like this? Shut up, go call him back." You know? She admonishes her. And the daughter-in-law goes, gets the beggar back home. The beggar comes and the way Swami narrates it, now the beggar is very happy thinking, "Amma, there is somebody who is going to respond to my plight and give me something." And when he goes now the mother-in-law comes down to the door, opens the door and tells the beggar, "Hey, you lazy fellow, get lost on your way. You are not going to get anything over here." And now the beggar is totally perplexed. You know, he says, "What made you, you know, that is what your daughter-in-law also had said. And now why are you calling me? I thought you were going to give me something." She says, no, the daughter-in-law has no right to dismiss you. Who is she to decide that we have nothing to give you? I am the one who should decide that there is nothing to give. So it's not about giving you anything. It's about she telling you that we won't give. Now that I have told you, get lost on your way. You know? So it is, all this is because of our ego that such scenarios, that such situations arise. So when we say giving up ego, It involves both, which is on one hand, you know, feeling for the other person, feeling the plight of the other person and responding. And on the other hand, realizing that God in His wisdom is doing everything perfectly. That's where that philosophy comes, that all that is happening is good for me. Everything is good. Inherently, everything is good. There's no absolute bad. All this comes from that. Comes from the conviction and faith in God's ultimate wisdom and love.
And The same God's wisdom and love which comes to the rescue when somebody is suffering is the last point that Swami is making. Mm. Again, a very, very important point in the context. So Swami is saying, first of all, that wisdom, that whatever happens is happening for a perfect reason, though it is not directly visible to me or it is not directly available to my understanding. Swami is saying that will lead you to understand that if I'm suffering today, there must be some reason for it. I would have done something to undergo this. Mm. And having that will make you repentant and make you change your ways. Right? It's a question which a lot of people will ask, wouldn't it be easier if I know what I'm suffering for? The simple answer to that is, how many times we know what mistake we have done and we justify ourselves? So it is not quite possible that every time we know what mistake we have done, we will accept it and say, "So I did that mistake and so I'm suffering now." How many times we even justify what mistakes we've done, but it is much beyond that. I think it's beyond the scope of today's discussion. We don't even have the time for that. But Swami is saying that if you have the right kind of repentance and if you change your ways in whatever way you feel that I need to learn this from my mistakes, as Swami would say, it is not because God wants you to suffer or it's not because God wants you to punish. The whole karma system is nothing but a means by which you learn lessons, you unlearn what has to be unlearned, you learn what has to be learned. Swami says, when I see that you have learnt it, then my grace might come and forgive you. Swami says, Baba's grace might come and forgive and even restore vision. Right? So the question whether our karmas will have to be suffered and we will have to undergo the whole process, Swami is saying, no, I might even forgive your karmas, but if the repentance is genuine and if the transformation is real.
On that note, dear listeners, we will bring this afternoon satsang to a close. We are indeed grateful to Swami for this beautiful satsang which spans across the globe. We have people from America, we have people from Singapore, we have people from Australia, we have people from India, people from across the globe joining in this global satsang, and it has all been made possible because of Swami's immense love, immense grace. So for that, we are always grateful to Swami. With gratitude in our hearts, we offer this at His lotus feet. And we shall see you next week, continuing with the conversations where we have left off. Same time, so do meet us there. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
Sai Rama, Sai Krishna, Sai Rama Krishna. Sai Rama, Sai Krishna, Sai Rama Krishna.
Sai Rama, Sai Krishna, Sai Rama Krishna.
Shirdi Sai, Arti Baba, Shirdi Satya Sai. Shirdi Sai, Parthi Baba, Shirdi Satya Sai. Durga Mata, Lakshmi Mata.
Durga Mata, Lakshmi Mata.
Durga Mata, Lakshmi Mata.
Durga Mata, Lakshmi Mata.
Satya Sai Mata. Say सर्वधर्म स्वरूपा साई सर्वनाम स्वरूपा सर्वधर्म स्वरूपा साई Shirdi Satya Sai